America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. There's a city in America that continues to surprise, delight, and confound all the predictions about its imminent decline. And of course, that's New York City. What we call in this podcast our indispensable city, because the most gifted among us in the arts, finance, and so many other pursuits find their way there. If we're going to project the future of our country, it's impossible to do it without looking ahead to the prospects for our enduring and still most important human creation, New York City. Take a walk on its streets, and you can sense the America now emerging. We discuss it all today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Craig Taylor. And he's written a book, I'm not certain exactly what you call it. I've read where it may be called something like documentary literature, New Yorkers, a City and Its People in Our Time. And Craig, I know you live in Canada, but you were in New York. Tell us for how long a period of time, and whether in fact in that period of time, as you were studying all the other New Yorkers, whether you began to think of yourself in any way as a New Yorker.
Well, I was in New York for about 6 years altogether. I moved there January 2014 to work on this book. And although I developed a sort of deep and abiding love for this city, I don't know if I myself am a New Yorker. I think in this work, it's always good to be a little bit of an outsider. I was endlessly made fun of for being a Canadian by various New Yorkers, but I realized that would probably be my identity at the end of it. And you need to be there for a lot longer, I think, to become a New Yorker.
Well, how long does it take to become a New Yorker if you intend to stay for a great length of time? I mean, just to get to know the city, to understand its rhythm, its heartbeat, how long do you think it takes someone?
Well, that was always an interesting question to me because I sort of placed this term New Yorker in front of people to see how they would react. And of course, some people who had been there for years and years and years still felt like they weren't quite New Yorkers. They didn't understand every last corner of the city. But then there are others who had been there in the case of one man a couple weeks, and he was already calling himself a New Yorker. Some people were too busy to call themselves a New Yorker. Some people were too attached to their home countries. So I liked seeing how people reacted to that word. Of course, then you had the born and bred New Yorkers who knew nothing else. They couldn't imagine another identity. So putting that word, that phrase in front of people was always an interesting exercise for me.
Well, you do write at the beginning of the book, and then you let all these interesting New York characters speak for themselves. You say that the city will never stop for you. You can come, or maybe this was someone else who said it, I don't know, but it was in your book. So the city will never stop for you. You can come, you can go. But I'm wondering, because I'm one of those people who lives just outside of New York in Connecticut. And there are times when I used to get off the train, I got to tell you, Craig, and I just wasn't ready for the energy. I don't know. I mean, it takes a certain amount of energy to get into that pattern. How you walk, the rhythm, the ballet on the sidewalk is one person described it. I mean, it really takes a lot of energy.
Absolutely. I'm glad you used that word because that's how I always think of it, is this energy that people plug into in New York, where it changes you. With some of the interviewees in the book, I saw how it enlarged them, it elevated them, it allowed them to become a sort of bigger version than themselves. And to others, I saw this energy had a punitive edge. It really punished them, it hurt them, it cut them. And so New York is, of course, it's a place, of course, it's a physical place, but it's also this energy that you cannot help but be a part of, and you have to gird yourself for when you step off that train or when you open that your apartment door. I often thought that I would put my hand on the doorknob and think, okay, here we go. Because it's never, and a lot of the interviewees in the book say that it's never going to change for you. It's never going to make allowances for you. You are in this river. You are just pushed along. And I think that's a very important trait of the city, and an everlasting trait, perhaps.
The ecology of the city. It was fascinating. One of your interviewees, who in fact himself is blind, and how he would talk about how he knew where he was based on the time of day and which neighborhoods he was going to, from, I think, 125th Street, which is in Harlem, all the way down to Houston Street. I mean, tell us about that, because I thought that was so emblematic.
Frank Sr. opens the book. He's a singer. He's blind. He sees the city with his ears, with his nose. And I could have written an entire book about Frank. He has a very unique way of looking at, of hearing, of smelling the city. And he was able, in a way, to give a history of smell to New York in his section, where he talked about the stink of Times Square, 70s and 80s, and, you know, the beautiful smell of Central Park and all of the sunscreens passing by him, you know, each individual person with their own cologne or sunscreen, and the sounds of voices changing, nationalities, races changing. As you walk through New York, you hear the voices change. I really wanted the book to touch on the five senses. I wanted to allow people to be immersed in the five senses of New York, and Frank was integral to that. He really opens the book in such a vivid way.
You, of course, have studied London and other places. How different is New York? I mean, is there any place on earth quite like it, as you, at least the parts you've explored and studied?
No, not at all. I mean, with doing these projects in different cities, some commonalities emerge, and people are people, and generally, you know, the struggle to find love, to find satisfaction in work, to live a good life is there wherever you do sorts of projects. But in New York, it was just done in a different way, and I think that's why people were drawn there, and why people stay there, is they're allowed to perform on this particular stage no matter what they do. If you're a pest control officer, you're still performing on one of the great stages in the world for your chosen profession. You know, if you're on Broadway, if you're a lawyer in a courtroom, the lawyer I spoke to talked about how in a federal court he had to stand still, but in a New York State courtroom he could move around like a Shakespearean actor. So I really loved that idea of the city, you know, allowing people to become who they wanted to be.
Do they have, in a way, a superiority complex? By that I mean, there are so many of us who've been in so many different fields and careers, and we always wonder, how would I perform in New York? I know, having been on radio, many times I said, gee, if I was on WOR or WABC, how would I do? And I think everybody aspires to New York in some fashion.
Absolutely, yeah, and it is the... It is the stage that so many want to get to, and there's a sports announcer. He's the voice of the Brooklyn Nets, and he felt that way. You know, he's speaking to not just Nets fans, but everyone out there in New York. The game is the game. You had to be true to the game. You had to, you know, you had to get that across as best you can, because this is the big time, and I just love that hearing. I loved hearing that from so many different people. There's an electrician who wires the Empire State, and so even for an electrician, it's there to perform on this the big stage.
Well, of course, you've got window washers. I mean, well, where else are there skyscrapers like New York City? I'm wondering about the differences uptown, midtown, and downtown, and then the differences that you perceived in the way people looked at life and themselves and where they were in the New York experience, depending upon the borough that they may be from. I know you talked to one woman in Brooklyn who said, I never go down to Manhattan or up to Manhattan. That's not a place I really want to be.
Really pushed myself to go out into every corner of the boroughs, and I, you know, I loved the fact that this project allowed me to, because there's such fondness and passion for these places. And there's a personal injury lawyer in the book who suffers from COVID. There's a big, long COVID section detailing his struggles. And, you know, at one point he sort of leans back and looks at his love of New York, his city, and how how Manhattan, in his mind, belongs to everyone. You know, you all feel like you have a piece of the towers or Radio City or all of these things. But for him to come back, to get on that 7 train and to go back to Queens, that is the true journey. And it brings him back to himself, back to his childhood, his sense of belonging. And I heard that again and again, just this, you know, true love for the borough that you returned to, in whatever way possible. That's not to say there aren't a lot of people who love being in Manhattan, but that profound love of that journey, of that tidal journey of flowing into Manhattan and flowing back out to where you're from was very special to a lot of people.
Well, of course, people come into New York City every day or to Manhattan from one of the outer boroughs. Then they also come in from Long Island, from Westchester County, from Connecticut, from New Jersey. How much do those people who, you know, live a portion of their lives and maybe one of the most central portions in terms of their identity, that being their profession, how much does New York, take from them, or how much do they give back to New York?
Well, I mean, that's one of the worries about the post-pandemic life, is that tidal shift of people coming in and going back out is going to change in some way. But it's such a surge of energy to come back to that word, you know, to have all of this humanity pressing in and then sort of flowing back out to where they're from, back to Connecticut or Westchester. And so, yeah, I did want to portray that in the book and get a sense of that sort of relationship, too, with people who are dealing with New York on a daily basis. The therapist in the book talks about how, with her clients, New York is always in the room with them. It's this living presence. And they talk about wanting to leave it or wanting to move farther out or wanting to get away from it. And I think a lot of people, you know, have that relationship with the city. It's alive in their lives. They're thinking about it all the time and negotiating with it all the time.
Yeah, it is a main character, whereas many other communities, you live in them, but they're rather plasticine or they're rather conventional. They don't look much different than any other city. But New Yorkers certainly feel differently. They want to teach you something, you said in the book. New Yorkers want to teach you something. What is that?
Well, I felt like there was a split in what I was taught. I mean, when you speak to 200 New Yorkers, you will obviously find out very practical things like where to get the best bagel and find out a lot about pizza, and I was even taught how to steal a car in Manhattan. But I noticed, too, over the course of this project, that there was so much more that I learned from these people. There were some very deep human lessons that ended up being taught to me about living amongst strangers, about living with the other, people who were not like you, which is integral to life right now, and just how to be a better human being, because, you know, in order to live a good New York life, you are striving for something. And so it was a profoundly moving process for me, learning from all of these eloquent people just how to live well. And people in New York will tell you how to live well. You don't have to ask. They will tell you. That's the great
thing.
Well,
how opinionated are New Yorkers as a group, would you say, as opposed to others? I mean, how much are they in your face? How frontal are they? And are they judgmental of you when you tell them, I'm not from here and I'll probably not be staying here? Do they want to encourage you to stay and to tell you that you're wrong for going back to perhaps your home roots?
Yeah, there was a lot of that. I mean, they kind of felt sorry for the fact that I wasn't born and bred in New York. I mean, that's the thing. You meet people who it's all they've known. The city is their life. To leave for a weekend is a sort of defeat. And so yeah, that identity was always there. It was always part of the conversations. But it's a welcoming, you know, it is the most welcoming place. And if you do decide you want it, it's there. I was really struck by how many New Yorkers were there to tell me quite forcefully about the history, about what New York stood for, about the statue in the harbor, about the importance of immigration, both from new immigrants and people who had been there for generations. So there were some themes, you know, in the eternal story of New York that were hammered home to me again and again. And given the political climate of the time I was there, it was really moving to hear this assertion that New York has to be what it's always been. It has to be a place of entry into this country.
In an article written about your book, this author said, my melancholy personal geography of used-to-be's now includes the dim sum hall where my wife and I had our wedding reception, the play skate space where I took my son when he was a toddler, the East Village Dive where I drank with some slightly random people when I just arrived and didn't know anyone else. And you talk in the book about the nostalgia that people have for things that are no longer there in New York. And that really helps to pinpoint the length and the durability of your New York experience.
Yeah, it's always there. And I think that review is a great example of, you know, someone not talking about the book, but about their own experience. You know, they want to prove that they are New Yorkers. You find that a lot with transplants to the city. They're fixated on showing, you know, how authentic their own experience is. But for the rest of us, yeah, you do build up this very emotional inner life with all of these restaurants, with these places that become vital to your own small, fragile community in the scene. And I think I always found in London it was about directions. You know, if someone knew London, they could tell you exactly how to get somewhere through its nonsensical streets. And in New York, a lot of the time it was about memory. It was about someone saying, well, I know this place more than you because I know what used to be here and I know what was there before. And I think that's a very important part of the city, this sort of living memory as it changes. And hopefully, you know, we won't be entering into a chapter where all of these restaurants and small local establishments are gone, because they're so important to the sort of collective memory of the place.
Craig Taylor is with us on America Trends. New Yorkers, a city and its people in our time. Now, for someone who listens to this podcast a lot, we look forward. We look at trends in our society and our culture. And I think it's so important to talk about New Yorkers and New York City, as you point out, Craig, particularly at this moment in time, when I was shocked, living in Connecticut, for years, people have been moving out of suburbs, and young people have been going and gravitating to the urban environment. And Connecticut, which bought into the suburban solution, we had been down on our luck for a number of years now. And all of a sudden, people left cities like New York, and we're rushing back into the suburbs. Now, this is 3 or 4 months into the pandemic, Craig, and I'm saying they can make that life decision, given the intensity of New York, the importance of New York as a character in your life, and they're giving it up so quickly, and this pandemic could be over in 6 months, 8 months. It would have been over had it been handled better, much sooner. But the question is, what do you see in this?
I think there are these shifts, these historical shifts that come and go, of course, in the 70s and in the 80s. There was a lot of people moving out of New York, a lot of people going into Long Island and other places. And then, of course, you saw the reverse of that, of people coming back and celebrating this urban environment. And right now, I think, personally, it might be too soon to see, you know, how things will shake out in the next while, but I think there is a kind of permanence, thankfully, in New York, and that even if a certain type of person or a certain amount of people clear out, the space will not be empty. It will change. It will adapt as it always has. And I think it's very important for cities like New York to go on because they teach lessons that certainly I wasn't taught living in a smaller place growing up, lessons about proximity, about having access to people different than yourself, extraordinary people that you see in a city. So I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic. Because I love these places so much, I'm optimistic that they surely will transform, but the result will be something lively again, that the lifeblood of New York won't flow out of it forever.
What does New York mean to America? I mean, what would America lose if New York didn't really exist in the way that it does? Its centrality for finance and for theater, being a portal for people coming into America, being accepting, well, first rejecting and then accepting, its window onto the rest of the world. I mean, what would America lose if it never regained that vitality?
A sense of itself, probably. I mean, it needs to be there. It needs to be a part of the nation. And what I loved about taking this place and introducing it to different people, including people across the U.S., is that there is no passive reaction to New York. There is no one shrugs and says, oh, I've never heard of the place. Tell me more. Everyone has a reaction to this place. They want to leave their hometown and go there. They They hate it and would never want to go there. They hate what it stands for. They're desperate to live a life there. You know, there's such a reaction to the power of the place that that it needs to be a part of the New York story and or a part of the American story. And I don't think it will lose that centrality. Change will come, and certainly the country is in the midst of a great change. But I saw again and again, especially speaking to people who had made the pilgrimage, how they would do it. You know, they would have done it in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. It's just there for a lot of people as a magnet.
But you do say that New Yorkers, and again, your book is all about the people of New York and how they negotiate all the twists and turns of the city, that they think their city is slipping. Now, I look at an editorial in the New York Post. New York City is on the brink. Here's what a new mayor can do to save it. And they talk about a range of things. It's lost 2.4% of its population just in 2020. So there are many people very worried about New York. When did you leave the city, having finished your book? And how much have you been looking in since? And do you think it is slipping?
Well, I left March 21st, 2020, because I had to come back when the border closed. But I'll be back, you know, as soon as I can. And I think it's definitely, there are worries. You know, there are some wonderful New York commentators and writers, including Jeremiah Moss, who writes Vanishing New York and really details, you know, how this ecosystem is being broken, is the destructiveness of the what is called in the book a sort of real estate disease, and also the a sameness. So in my book, there aren't so many facts and figures and statistics about New York as it is now, but there's a more of a general sense of sameness, as one person calls it, the sense that the city is just block by block becoming too much of the same thing, too many Duane Reads, too many Bank of Americas, too many, you are losing a sense of a varied ecosystem. And so that is what I heard repeated again and again. And there are people who want to fight for that, but it's a very tough fight in a city charging forward every day like New York. And the pandemic, of course, is going to change things as well.
One of the things that the New York Post talks about is the blood flow of the city, the subway. The MTA is still missing 2/3 to 3/4 of its riders, who fear not just the virus, but also soaring disorder. How important is public transportation to keeping this city moving? To me, it is startling what they are able to do every day. And I have not been in the city using public transportation. I've been on surface roads when I've gone, something I've been very reluctant to do, which is often to drive into New York, but I've been doing it of late. So tell me what you think about the importance of the subway and just mass transit as you talk to New Yorkers.
It's crucial, and I feel so saddened by, not just in New York, but all over, these great transportation systems are having probably the roughest time they've ever had, and the sense of fear is just so pervasive. But without this system, which, you know, as one of the interviewees talks about, does almost superhuman things. It moves, the amount of people it moves around, it still shocks me. And the amount of work that has to go in every day and how it has to just be patched and patched and patched because you can never shut it down. It's a phenomenal undertaking that we take for granted. And my hope is that somehow people will return, because it is not only a place for us to physically get from A to B, but it is a democratic meeting point. It's a juncture for so many different types of New Yorkers. And there's a reason why the New York subway lines are on the cover of my book. There's a reason why the London Underground lines are on the cover of my previous book, because it speaks to the multiplicity of the city. All these lines, all of these people, all you need is a certain amount of money and you can get on no matter who you are. And there is, you know, a downside to the ripeness of some New York City subway cars, but in the subway you see this mix that you would never see anywhere else. And I think it's a crucial part of the city, and I just really, really hope that it gets back on its feet soon and somehow maintains what it once was.
Can you explain to me, New York is now a majority non-white city. When you go into the city, it is remarkable the ethnic blend, people getting along because they need each other, because, you know, there is an ecology to a city and making it work. And I think you celebrate so many of those people. You place them side by side in your book. You have a police officer. You have a trans social justice activist. You have a lawyer, a car thief, and they all exist in New York in some melange. But explain to me this, because I've never been able to quite figure this out. Our last president, Donald Trump, was truly a New Yorker, one of the bold-faced New Yorkers that you chose not to interview for this book. You wanted more people that we didn't really know and didn't have that kind of identity. But how could he have lived throughout his life in New York, growing up in Queens, seeing this multiplicity, understanding the vibrancy of these ethnicities, and then becoming really a folk hero to the most provincial, parochial individuals who lived in rural America and not have any appreciation for what diversity had brought to his city and his own fortunes?
Well, there's a reason why he didn't get welcomed back to New York after his stint as president. And when I think about this question that you've eloquently put forward, I think of the nanny in the book. There's a nanny to the super rich who talks about a group of people, the super rich, who never need to mingle and mix and see the other in New York. They live on this sort of fragrant upper layer. And what that does to their children, in her words, is a kind of, there's a sort of corrosiveness to their thinking. They see minorities, but only in support roles, giving them food, cooking them food, doing their laundry. They never take, as she says, they never take the A train. They never are in those cars with other people. They never have to see that New York is wonderful because of this mix, because others belong there. And so, yeah, I think it's shocking to hear. It's very real. There's a very real element of the city that just does not need to mix. And I don't think that does them any good. I think from what I heard in the words of the sommelier, from the nanny, from the personal assistant, is that it brings about a kind of attitude in the super rich that I don't see as helpful in terms of the cohesiveness of society, certainly not in a city like New York.
What do you think happens when some of the New Yorkers who've only been out of the city if they've left and gone into northern New Jersey or southern Connecticut, what do you think happens to them over what period of time? What do you think they miss first or most about New York?
The knowledge, you know, we talked a bit about the opinionated nature, and I saw that opinionatedness as just knowing what's right, knowing I had so many people who said, you know, this is my New York, this is where I get this food, this is where I get, you know, this bagel, this is where I get, and just knowing this the correct way to do things, that you are getting the best that is out there. You are very strong in your opinions. No one's going to cross your opinion. And when you leave New York, and I heard this from a few born and bred New Yorkers, you're really thrown because all of a sudden you can't lean back on that certainty. Yeah, I think that's what I heard from them as being one of the great challenges of leaving the city. But then, why would you want to leave the city? That was often said to me too. Everything is there. Everything you need is right there.
Well, the name not to be mentioned, but Woody Allen, when he did that film, when he went to Los Angeles and he's driving around L.A., and, of course, he looked like a fish way out of water, clearly. What about the idea of coming to New York and making it with $30? You talk about that in the book. Is that still possible?
Again, this is the nanny who's talking about the inability to do exactly that, to show up in New York. And I think there are still people trying, but with these projects, I was able to see how hard that is. Over the course of the book, I spoke to a young man named Antoine who had got on a Greyhound bus in Arkansas and taken it to Port Authority. And I could see that just coming to New York with nothing but this hope was incredibly, incredibly hard these days, not just because of the job market, not just because of the real estate market, but it does seem to be a place that is pushing people out, pushing people to its corners. And Antoine, when I left New York, was living out in the Rockaways and had felt the sort of brutal edge of New York and how it wasn't really a place that was welcoming those who showed up with a few dollars and a dream. So that was my experience of the $30 hope.
I always wonder about that, Craig, and you've talked to the people of New York. When I see somebody selling pretzels on the street corner or just doing a number of myriad jobs in retail or in the food service industry, I say, where do they live? They can't afford to spend time at night in Midtown Manhattan where they're working by day. Where do they go and how difficult is it for somebody without means? I just read some article that said unless you have $150,000 a year, they can't believe, I think this was some business people talking, they can't believe that you could exist in New York.
This project introduced me to people who were gracious enough to take me into their homes and show me how one lives with 10 roommates in Corona and other parts of Queens. Your life becomes shorn of anything except work, and I saw that again, people who were in New York but not living New York, certainly not the New York that many others know. And your life just becomes this nonstop cycle of work, and you sort of have glimpses of the city, what it is, what it could offer, but for a lot of people that's the reality of New York, especially for a lot of people who just arrived, and seeing 10 people in a couple rooms is definitely a part of New York that shouldn't be ignored.
Zach Arkin, a former cab driver. And cab drivers have so much knowledge. I'm just curious, when you talk to a former cab driver and the impact that Uber and Lyft have had on New York City, because that's part of the experience as well, on top of the ground as well as the subway underground, how important are their observations? Because he said something that was really interesting. He said the thing about New York is the eyeballs. You have to make contact, because if you're not aware, I think he was saying, and if you're not really paying attention, you're going to get taken in New York.
Yeah, Zach was moving to Florida when I met him, and so he had a lot of parting wisdom to share about the experience of New York. And one of it was, you know, keep people in your sight, make eye contact, keep it. And I think on a deeper level, it's about presence. Just be present. You have to just be in the moment. And Zach had, you know, his career as a cab driver allowed him to think in a quite poetical way, philosophical way about the city and its populace. And for me, the crucial point in his section is when he just talks about how in New York people are the textures. You know, you're going to discover this setting and these buildings, but the textures in New York, the different flavors are its people. And I think he was a very good person to be able to say that, having had thousands of them in the back of his cab over his career. He really knew that, you know, that is what he valued in the city and was going to miss when he went to Florida.
I wonder if, in closing, I can ask you a very unfair question, which is that you've studied London, and you've studied New York. And in many ways, they both are very theatrical cities, also financial centers for the Western world. Yet, I'm just curious, do you think that one really lives a whole different way of life than the other? And which did you prefer, or where could you put down more roots, London or New York?
I moved to London when I was about 23, so I had a long chunk of my life there, so it's very dear to me, and I found a way to exist there, and I love that place. But New York just always, you know, to come back to that sense of energy. If you go there and you're accepting of it, it will take you along. And in some ways, I felt like I had a very unfair relationship with New York because I was there to do this incredible project. So I wasn't slaving away in an office every day. I was on the subway, getting to see every borough, every corner, talking to these extraordinary people. So perhaps that's colored my experience of it. But yeah, it is a place that I would like to go back to, and I will. And I just know that it's so generous. That's what the street photographer I interviewed says. You know, it is the most generous place. No matter what you're doing, it will keep coming. If you're interested in people, there are always new people coming. And so that is what draws me back to it. And I would love to have another shot because that's all you really get is another shot of being there for a little while longer.
Well, Craig, if you go back to New York, say 5 years from now, because we like to look forward on this podcast, what do you imagine? I mean, the pandemic's over. America perhaps is coming back to some normalcy. What do you imagine you'll see at that point in time in New York?
I'm going to go very optimistic, and I'm going to think that everyone who was on the fence, who was thinking, should I leave, has left. And the city is full of enthusiasts. It is a different place. Maybe some of the money has drained away. Maybe some of that rich echelon of people has decided they want to live in a different place. And so hopefully, you know, in 5 years, it's alive with a different kind of energy, you know, a more frantic creative energy that might not be for everyone, but will, you know, reestablish New York as a place that things can get done, where people can move and enact those dreams without, you know, having to sell their souls. So I'm hopeful about it. I'd love to be a part of that in some small way, but you got to be optimistic. I mean, that's the thing about New York people. They can't help but be resilient. That's the thing that just kept them going again and again. There was one gentleman who told me, sure, I'd leave New York if something terrible ever happened. But a terrorist attack, you know, a pandemic, a financial crash, a superstorm, that's not enough. Something terrible has to happen. So I hope the city is full of people with that spirit and that love of the place. And that would be my optimistic dream.
Well, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. New Yorkers, a city and its people in our time. And Craig Taylor, you may not live there permanently yet, but you have made a great contribution with this book, and I'm sure New Yorkers in all the boroughs are reading it with great interest and seeing their own reflection back in your book. Congratulations, and thank you for being with us on America Trends.
Thanks so much, Larry. Thanks.